Jai Ma, it's a joy to connect with all our friends and co-travelers on the path, on the great journey. So without much of a background, we'll come to the questions, which are very interesting and beautiful questions, I must say. And this is a different kind of format, but a very useful format to pick up. Maybe it could go on as a whole series of certain statements in Savitri, certain words which do raise questions in the mind, and we'll go one by one. So the first is the three serves, or the three body trinity. So this comes in the little mind. Shobindo describes these two layers of mind before he describes the something which is beyond. So the three layers of mind is the little mind, and then we have the greater mind. So what is the difference? Why doesn't he, of course they are continuous in a certain sense, but why does he describe it like that? So the little mind is a mind which is completely in ignorance, whereas the greater mind is a mind which has begun to open towards the light. So that's the main difference. And beyond that is the, of course, overmind and the supermind, which is the original. We can say supermind is the mind of God. So how does he know? How does he act? So it's the omniscience of the divine, is the supermind, both omniscience as well as omnipotence. And then this supermind, as it leans towards earth for creation, we see that it first enters into the what we can describe as the overmind plane, which we see in Savitri described, last three or four cantos in book two. So then from the overmind, then the play of separative, not exactly, because now one has to become many. So each idea force begin to release its own potency and energy into creation. So let's take the Hindu pantheon. So we have at the origin, we have the creator, the preserver and the destroyer. Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, they are three of them are together. There is a conception of their being together. And that would be the highest plane of the overmind, where the three are together. And of course, Krishna is there. He is all over. So we'll not go into that aspect. But then they have their own world. So in the overmind, we have the world of the gods. So each god has its own world. And then from there are ganas. There are different entities, forces which are being released from there. And as they enter into the creation, for example, out of Shiva, the world of Shiva, there are Rudra energies. Now when Rudra energies enter into creation, they become more and more independently active. Of course, they are governed ultimately by... but what is meant is that if a Rudra power is working, it tornadoes and storms and upheavals, then it will listen to Shiva. But it will be very difficult to calm it by the power of Vishnu, which we see in the story of Daksha Prajapati. So we have the greater mind, where these forces have begun to start their career, their journey independently. And then when it comes, the mind, the little mind, then they have become completely, there is the separative consciousness. They don't really, they are not apparently connected with each other. They cannot, can never be a complete disconnectedness. So in the process of evolution, something very similar follows. And in the present state of humanity, basically the little mind is active, and the little mind is very simply what Shobindo describes as the dwarf three-body trinity. And he uses the word surf. So it's dwarf, which shows us that, you know, the what, why he has used the word dwarf, it's very interesting. So dwarf is basically someone who has got a stunted growth. It has not developed to its full potential. That's why he is using the word dwarf. And this term comes in different types of spiritual literature. So it is something which could grow. That's why the paradox of Vamana Avatar. So his dwarf seems, you know, he cannot do anything much, and yet it grows into the three worlds. So that's another story which we can talk about later. So dwarf is basically implies that it is stunted in its growth. Means this mind, though it has a potential, the little mind of growing further, but right now it has got a ceiling where it has got stuck. So it's a dwarf. Three-bodied, so it has three basic layers, though there are many other sub-layers. So the three basic layers are the physical mind, the vital mind, and the rational mind. These three derive from other three. Other three which are in the greater mind are the higher mind, the illumined mind, and the intuitive mind. And then these three derive from the original three sides of the three powers of the supermind. But in the supermind, they act as one together, which is the apprehending mind, the comprehending mind, and the representative. So supermind. The apprehending supermind, the comprehending supermind, and the representative supermind. Since we have touched it, we can quickly mention. So in the supermind, each idea force which is released has its own truth. So to take just a crude example, that for us, earth is physical matter. But in the supramental, the real idea, the earth is a representative of what? It's a representative of the divine which is hidden and which is going to evolve through a long journey. So we can put it in different words, but that's the truth of earth. So cow, here is something, but in the supramental it will be light, many-sided action of light. So there is the representative supermind, and then out of it you have the comprehending supermind, which simultaneously holds all these different aspects together in a single comprehension. It's like somebody who has a global consciousness has simultaneous access to everything. And then the apprehending supermind, where it begins to go out. So it is apprehending, you know, that's how the word Shobhinda is used. So it has begun to travel towards ignorance. And then comes these three greater mind powers, which is intuitive mind, where we see a little reflection of, in a flash it sees things in the depths, what is hidden, it is able to see. And then along with that, we have the reflective mind and or the illumined mind, and then we have the higher mind. Now that's a subject, but we need not go into it, but since we have touched upon it, so the higher mind is a mind where things are seen as symbols. So mountain is not just a mountain, but a symbol of tapasya. So river is not just a river, but a symbol of life flowing towards its goal. So this is how the vision in higher mind is. But from that higher mind, as this plunges towards ignorance, we have these three layers. So these three layers are the rational mind, the vital mind, and the physical mind, which is the subject we are talking about. So physical mind is the mind which has two aspects. We can understand it like that. One is it deals obviously with physical things. So it's a mind which is all about form, shape, externalities. And therefore it is depends on the senses. So it will have a subsection of sensory mind. What is called as manas in Indian thought. It will have a further subsection of material mind, subsection of cellular mind. So you see, so physical mind is the mind which determines the outer character of a person. Unfortunately, not really the character, but habits which we mistake for character, which includes the physical features, all this. It is the mind which prominently acts through the genes. So it's a mind which organizes material life. Both in creation, but it's particularly in human beings, we use the word physical mind. If we go a little below the human, then we will use the word material mind, which is active in creation, cellular mind everywhere. But otherwise, as far as human beings are concerned, we use the word physical mind, and it is the one which fixes the character, outer character, habits, tendencies. Now, this is the first layer. It is very good at organizing things. You see, there are people who are so touchy about how the little things are kept in the kept on the table, how a picture is hanging. All this is action of the physical mind. It gets into a hyper mode. But the problem of the physical mind is because it is turned all outward. It has no clue about inner things. So it is admirable, as Shobhinda describes, a worker admirable, a thinker crude. So we'll see paradoxically that there are scientists who are admirable in terms of their skills, what they are doing. But when it comes to thought and philosophy or even imagination, they cannot function there because the physical mind is very active. Now this is the three-body trinity. This is the first one. Now, if this only remains, it will be very difficult because human beings will just remain like little animals who are tied to their external scene. So out of this physical mind, there emerges what is called as the vital mind, which is the next level of the emergence. And vital mind is a mind of fantasy and imagination. All of us know about it. So this mind begins to conjure images which are not understandable or definable by the physical mind. So if two people who are, let's say, meet one with the physical mind and the vital mind, and they sit on a table and talk about what is the moon, so the physical mind fellow will say that it's nothing but a, you know, like they say, sun is a ball of fire, so this will be what, a cold and barren desert, a satellite of Earth. Yes, that would be the most accurate description. That's it. So you make a person with a vital mind speak about. He will say, "Oh, moon is it's all symbolizes romance and charm and all that." He will say. If you bring a person of the higher mind, then he'll say, "Oh, it is the symbol of the light which illumines us in darkness." So he it is held on Shiva's forehead. If you go still further, if you go to the Vedic rishis, they will say, "Oh, it's a symbol of the soma, the delight and sweetness of the divine." So we'll see that vital mind begins to escape from the confines of the physical mind and the sensory mind. So its role is very evident, because in human beings, you have to, the evolution has to go on. In the animals, we don't know whether there is a vital mind is active or not. To some extent, probably it is, because they also probably imagine that there have been studies on that, but that's going into a different direction. So basically, vital mind is the mind of imagination, fantasy, which colors things. They are mixed. They may be right or wrong. So, but it at least provides us an escape. So it has serves its role. Then beyond the vital mind, again, we are on the three body trinity. No, they are not Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, certainly not. So the third is the rational mind. Now, why does rational mind come? Now, imagine physical and vital mind, the two people sit together and they start quarreling. So the rational mind will come and it will start taking the primary data of the senses, which the physical mind takes. And it will also, it will not completely discard the imagination or possibilities. So here in the rational mind, the imaginations become possibilities. And then it will weigh them together, analyze them, essay them, and arrive at some kind of a tentative conclusion. So this is the three-body trinity. And Shobindu used the word serve. So why it is called as the serve? Because actually it is serving a higher purpose. But it doesn't know. A rational mind person thinks, "I am the best and I know everything." Because he can analyze everything. But evolution goes on, and as human beings evolve, there are like seers, saints, sages, they have all gone past these three layers of mind. And then what happens? They will use these three layers to express. So they are serfs. So a person living in the higher mind may use a story as a symbol. So you may say, is this story true or not? It's fantasy. Let's say Sri Ramakrishna told so many stories. They're not like literally true that a man on the Mahavat is sitting and there is a person blocking the elephant. It's not that this story happened or not happened, but it conveys a truth. So this is how they will use the physical, vital and the rational mind. Or like Sri Aurobindo, use a reason in all through the life divine and the synthesis of yoga. So he's not arriving at the conclusion through the rational mind. He has arrived at through the direct vision and perception of the seers, but he is using the language of the rational mind as an instrument. So they are serfs. Similarly, the physical mind. One classic example is when people went to the mother and asked that, you know, in Golconda there was a problem while constructing, and all these great scientists couldn't arrive at a conclusion. So they went to the mother and asked her. She remained quiet for a moment. They were looking for water somewhere, and the water diviner had come and they couldn't, and mother just remained quiet for some time, then says, "Here you'll find water." And then they asked, "Mother, how could you know it?" Now this is the mind which transcends the senses, and yet it is a kind of super sense if we want to use it. So these are the three layers of the mind which are described in Savitri. I'll just read a few lines, then we'll go further, because each of the question is very fascinating, and I don't want to, there should be a balance otherwise. So the dwarf three-body trinity, just we'll read a few lines and then proceed. And Page 245 in Savitri, a dwarf three-bodied trinity was her serf. First, smallest of the three, but strong of limb. He is even described classically, you know, even physical. A low brow with a square and heavy jowl. A pygmy thought, needing to live in bounds, forever stooped to hammer fact and form. This is what the physical mind is. Absorbed and cabined in external sight, it takes its stand on nature's solid base. A thinker admirable, a technician admirable, a thinker crude, a riveter of life to habit's grooves, obedient to gross matter's tyranny, a prisoner of the molds in which it works, it binds itself by what itself creates. So this is one part. Now each of the line is wonderful, but obviously, we could go on for a whole week on this. So then on page 247, we have the second aspect of the three-bodied trinity. A fiery spirit came next of the three. Now he is describing the mind of fantasy and imagination, the vital mind. And look how he describes. A hunchback rider of the red wild ass. It can, you know, take you suddenly. A rash intelligence leaped down lion-maned from the great mystic flame that rings the worlds and with its dire edge eats at being's heart. Then sprang the burning vision of desire. So this, it gives form to desire. See, if desire doesn't get a form, then people often say that I'm just restless. They don't know why they are restless. But if the vital mind is active, this restlessness will take a concrete form. Maybe an image of a human being, person, or it'll a string of words. And then you know, okay, I am restless for this person. It's not true. It's just a play of the vital mind. And so then the third mind is, of all these powers, page 249, of all these powers, the greatest was the last, arriving late from a far plane of thought into a packed, irrational world of chance, where all was grossly felt and blindly done. Why he's saying this is because if you look at only the outer facts of life, it'll appear a chance play. Why things happen the way they happen? So there is no particular understanding or explanation. Our rational mind doesn't have a deeper sight. But it tries to make sense, poor fellow. So it'll build theories, like for example, theories can be fantastic that you did some karma in your previous life. Now it's like a non-verifiable fact. The hardcore logician will say, no, I want verifiable facts. So you have to, at this level, it tries to organize life according to it tries to read the patterns, tries to understand them. To an extent, partially it succeeds and partially it fails. Probably largely it fails, it just has its own logic. So all this is described, and at the end, Shurbindo naturally shows the limits. And finally, he says that, page 258, above in a high, breathless stratosphere, overshadowing the dwarfish trinity, lived aspirants to a limitless beyond. Now, there are beings who are living in the higher realms, the greater mind, which he describes in the next canto. So, we'll come to the next question. And the next question, it's very interesting observation. I must say that it's one of the most beautiful. It's not an image, actually it can be seen in subtle vision, but Sri Aurobindo describes the two paths, so it has practical implication, very practical in heavens of the ideal. So it describes these two paths, very beautiful, and I will certainly read some passages from there. And these two paths are described as, or the words that have been given as key is deathless rose and deathless flame. So in Savitri, of course, deathless rose comes once and deathless flame comes twice. Once deathless flame comes when the gods light up the deathless flame. And deathless rose comes only one. Of course, deathless flame comes again in heavens of the ideal. And deathless rose is there in heavens of the ideal only. In another poem of Sri Aurobindo, there is the poem on the rose of God. So what is this rose? So a rose, we know, is a flower of love. It denotes love. But it's a love very strangely surrounded by thorns. It has many colors, many hues. But that apart, so deathless rose is the... why he is using the word deathless? Because deathless word also comes. So what is the difference between deathless and immortal? He could have said immortal rose, a rose that never dies. Now deathless implies there is a movement, but a movement which is not subject to death. In fact, the mother uses the word deathless body. So there is, she describes the difference between immortality and deathless body. So immortality is easy to discover. You discover the psychic being, you discover the consciousness of immortality. The Vedic rishis discovered the consciousness of immortality by entering the infinite, because infinite cannot die. Only the limited can die. Similarly, a representative of the infinite is within us, the psychic being. You discover the psychic being, you discover your immortality. So what is deathless? Deathless implies there is a movement that is taking place, but there is nothing which is undone. Or as it is undone, the redoing is taking place at the same time. So to put it in context, it's like in the human body, constantly there is new cells which are being created and there are old cells which are dying. So in a child, the new cells are being built so beautifully, so marvelously that, you know, you don't get the impression of any decay, even though the old cells are going. But after a time, 30 years or maybe earlier, the process of disintegration takes over the process of new building. So death begins to shadow us. In a sense, the destruction process starts at beginning, but it begins to run faster than the creation. And at the end, the body becomes old, decrepit, and it dies. So deathless is that it escapes the law of death. That means the progress is totally commensurate with the push that is being given, the power that is being given. And if I have to use the analogy, well, for example, you can make a track where, these magnetic trains which run on, so where there is no loss of energy by friction. So the train is completely driven by the amount of energy that has gone into it driving. There is no loss. So no loss of energy, no loss of the force that has gone into whatever it is building and creating. And therefore, there will be no death. It is like body is undoing itself forwards. That's how the mother used the word. Which is different from an immortal body. And later on, if you can do it constantly, you will arrive at the deathless body, which is not subject to death. Whereas death-bound body is something different. So here there is implicit within it a movement. There is a journey, and in both these descriptions of the deathless rose and the deathless flame, we'll see the sense of a journey. So where is the journey beginning? It's beginning here. The deathless rose, it begins in the heart. And the deathless flame begins in the mind. Very clearly, these are the two paths, if you want to connect it. The path of love, bhakti, surrender, which is one path. The path of the deathless rose. And the other is the path of tapasya, which largely begins with the mind, where there is one's own effort with which one is climbing. And ultimately, you will go to the house of flame and, you know, where this flower blooms fully. So we'll just read a few lines. Page 277, the heavens of the ideal. This is, of course, as we know, this is the beginning of the overmind. After which there is in the self of mind and the world soul, which is the overmind proper. And then comes the kingdoms of greater knowledge, where the overmind is jutting on to the supermind, like the line. So these are the four cantos which describe it. So Shivindo uses the word, the heavens of the ideal mind were seen. In the Indian pantheon, it is called a Swaralok, not Swarga. Swarg is the vital world, but Swaralok. So the rishis went to Swaralok, and that's how they could see Satyam, Ritam, Vrahatam, and that's how from there they could see the supermind, which is right there. Before Swaralok, you cannot, and that's why we see Hanuman learning the secrets of creation, all the powers with sun, but as the sun god is moving around, he cannot enter there to the sun world, because if he tries it, but Indra sends him down, because Indra is the godhead of the overmind there. But he then learns it as the rays. So that's the description of what is called in the Swarlok. Those who want to connect it with Indian thought, heavens of the ideal is the Swarlok. Now from here you can understand something of the supermind. That's how when it is said, Shurbindo, people make such a hullabaloo of it that Swami Vivekananda told him about the supermind. No. Swami Vivekananda definitely had access to the Swarlok. And therefore he knew what supermind is. That's how the Vedic rishis had access to the Swarlok. They talk about it. Even in Gayatri Mantra we have Om Bhur Bhuva Swa Tat Savitur Varenyam. So from there they could have an access. So Swami Vivekananda, when Shurbindu in his tapasya has reached there, that point, he points the way that look here, that's where you have to go. That's your destiny, your destination. That's all. It's like something beautiful. So it's not that he entered into the supermind and then life would have been very different. So that's the Swarlok which is being described here. And there are two ways to ascend there. One is through the deathless rose, which is blooming in the heart as a bud. It blooms through bhakti, surrender, love. And that journey is so delightful, the path of surrender. So we'll just read a few lines, very, very beautiful. The lovely... In a tremulous rapture of the heart's insight and the spontaneous bliss that beauty gives, the lovely kingdoms of the deathless rose. This is I call it a VVIP road to the divine. Everything is here so madhuram, sundaram. Above the spirit caged in mortal sense are superconscious realms of heavenly peace. Below, the inconscient, sullen, dim abyss. Between, behind our life, the deathless rose. Above, across, the covert air, the spirit breathes, a body of the cosmic beauty and joy. Now, we come to these few lines. It blooms forever at the feet of God. Look at the description of this deathless rose, which is, we should not rush to call it the psychic being, but well, that's how it is. But here he is using that particular you. It is the divine love which is encased within creation. So there are two access keys to us. One is the divine love and the other is the divine power of tapasya. These are the two which are lifting us. So divine love, what holds the divine love is the psychic being. So we can use, but basically here it is the deathless rose is the divine love which is enclosed within creation as a bud. And this is the path we can take. Fed by life's sacrificial mysteries, here too its bud is born in human breasts. Then by a touch, a presence or a voice, all of us are aware of this, the world is turned into a temple ground and all discloses the unknown beloved. Wherever you are going, whatever you are doing, you are filled with that joy because it is disclosing. Some people come, they come to ashram and they are so happy, jubilant. They see everything is so beautiful. Madhuram, madhuram, sundaram. Because that suddenly that bud has opened. Somebody else may come, he may not, feel this way. So that's a blessing. So this is one part. When this bud blooms, then even when your outward touches of life are hurting you, the ego, yet your inner self will say, the psychic being will say, teri talwar, sorry for the Hindi, teri talwar ke niche main nachiyan karke thaiyan thaiyan. I am dancing and each drop of blood that is coming out of my body is dancing with rapture. Because this is the deathless rose, its influence. All discloses the unknown beloved. In an outburst of heavenly joy and ease, life yields to the divinity within and gives the rapture offering of its all. And the soul opens to felicity. A bliss is felt that never can wholly cease. Once this comes, whatever happens, it may take you a few moments, but you will come in contact with it. A sudden mystery of secret grace, flowers goldening our earth of red desire. All the high gods who hid their visages from the soil, passionate ritual of our hopes, reveal their names and their undying power. So this is the one part, the deathless rose, the power of divine love within the psychic being, which blooms and takes us to through one type of stair. It's the VVIP. I use this word. The other is also there as a green channel. Nothing to declare. See, there is a little difference between the two. So that comes on the next page 279. on the other side of the eternal stairs. So this is all divine has equipped us with everything to arrive at him. It's just that we are looking for wrong things. The mighty kingdoms of the deathless flame. Now this is where, you know, Dante describes it in Divine Comedy, and even there are other where you see tapasvis sitting on higher planes of consciousness. So that deathless flame, this is the flame of aspiration which is reaching out with its flaming intensity, is the power of tapasya basically. The mighty kingdoms of the deathless flame aspire to reach the being's absolutes out of the sorrow and darkness of the world, out of the depths where life and thought are tombed, lonely mounts up to heaven the deathless flame. It is the difference. It is alone, but it's, you see this difference in Swami Vivekananda and Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. Sri Ramakrishna's path is path of the deathless rose, basically. But Swami Vivekananda is path of the deathless flame in different tires. In a veil, nature's hallowed secrecies, it burns forever on the altar mind. It sprees the souls of dedicated gods. Humanity, its house of sacrifice, once kindled, never can its flaming cease. If fire along the mystic paths of earth, it rises through the mortal's hemisphere, till borne by runners of the day and dusk, it enters the occult eternal light. And see, as you rise, now what is the difference? When you meet a tapasvi and a bhakta, this is a fundamental difference. A bhakta is always full of delight, always full of, you know, surrendered. But if you meet a tapasvi, what will be his approach? So just a few lines below, and then we'll come to the third question. A thunder rolling mid the hills of God, tireless, severe is that tremendous voice. Exceeding us, to exceed ourselves they call, and hid us and bid us rise incessantly above. Far from our eager reach, those summits live, too lofty for our mortal strength and height. Hardly in a dire ecstasy of toil, climbed by the spirit's naked athlete will. Austere, intolerant, they claim from us efforts too lasting for our mortal love. Our hearts cannot cleave to, nor our flesh support. Only the eternal strength in us can dare to attempt the immense adventure of that climb and the sacrifice of all we cherish here. So we can use the word knowledge, path of knowledge, tapasya and path of bhakti, whatever way we want to put it. And deathless rose is that divine love which is carrying us always forward. And if we are identified with it, then we are on one track. The other is the power of knowledge through which we are moving. So that is the deathless flame. And then we come to the third question. The significance of the color purple. This of course is the short one. So we have several places purple is mentioned. Purple robe, purple suns. Mother's prayer, there is the word purple which is mentioned. When Gautama Buddha Siddhartha, he in a vision, he comes to the mother. I can't use the word vision because he actually comes. And then he says, I see in your heart a diamond which is put in purple clothes. But outside there is a dull blue luster, as if it doesn't want, it wants to hide it. So you see, many of these yogis, it's very interesting, that prayer of the mother, message from Sakyamuni. So, and I know of some yogis who are like that. They will hide themselves in the garb of most ordinary humanity. Shubhendu himself did it, and he says, till my secret was given. So why they do it? Because it's very convenient to carry on with the sadhana. They look like anybody. They are cool guys, so to say, outwardly. But there is tremendous inner labor. They are fully, you know, that is going on. So the purple, now we come back to purple, because this was about the mother concealing itself, that purple sheath in a dull blue. And Siddhartha, the Gautama, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, he sees it. And he says, why are you hiding it? Now, purple is always a sign of royalty, of power. So usually it is associated with vital power. And we will see that kings used to use the purple robe. Sometimes even the priests, if we go back to the ancient So they would also wear the purple robe. So whether we take it as in terms of thought or the vital energy, it signifies power, royalty, control, command. So, I mean, I'm not saying people should wear a purple dress, but you know, see, it's a rare thing. Some people wear it. It's a very, very striking dress. It automatically draws your attention. It's not a very common color. So purple, basically, if we see something in purple, it's a mix of the red and the yellow color, red and the blue color. So blue is the color of the mind in its ascension, and red is the color of the earth. So something which is linking the two. So coming from the skies, it holds the garden of power. And it is connected to earth, so its power is basically upon all that is manifesting in earthly life. So purple is the symbol of that, and that's what we see in Savitri. She comes in the triple soul forces. So in the triple soul forces, the Madonna of Might is described as wearing the purple robe. So we can just quickly read a little bit of these lines. As Savitri enters, because the next one is also from the triple soul forces. So it is described that she sees a woman. Yes. Page 508. On past she in her spirit's upward route. So this purple will come also in glory and fall of life. When the glory of life is described, then there is a description of griefless countries under purple suns. So that's again purple, that symbol of royalty, insignia of something which is powerful and which governs. So we see griefless countries, their purple suns are. This is not blues, which people are. So dark blue is different color. So an ardent grandeur climbed mid ferns and rocks. A quiet wind flattered the heart to warmth. A finer perfume breathed from slender trees. All beautiful grew, subtle and high and strange. Here on a boulder carved like a huge throne. Now you see the description. Who sits on the huge throne? A woman sat in gold and purple sheen. With the trident and the thunderbolt. Her feet upon a crouching lion's back. A formidable smile curved round her lips. Heaven fire laughed in the corner of her eyes. Her body a mass of courage and heavenly strength. She menaced the triumph of the nether gods. A halo of lightnings flamed around her head. And sovereignty, a great Cestus zoned her robe, and majesty and victory sat with her, guarding in the wide cosmic battlefield against the flat equality of death and the all-leveling insurgent night. So I have often, people on Durga Puja, they look for something. Read this line. This is the darshan of Durga Ma. And he uses the word, I wear the face of Kali when I kill. I am Durga. And I am Lakshmi. So all in the vital world, the action of the Divine Mother, she is ruling over all. And that's what is described as the word purple here. So this is the purple. And then the next question is also from the triple soul forces. And that is about the man of sorrows. So yes, he comes in the mother's prayer also. He is described in the triple soul forces. So we'll read about. So who is the man of sorrows and mother of sorrows? So we have an allusion to the Christian, to the biblical story. There is a reference here also. Madonna of suffering, mother of grief divine. She is the mother of sorrows, because that is the next question. So we can take both of them together. So mother of sorrows bears all our agony within her heart. And if you read, it has come, it is not in original Christianity, by the way, as far as I know. I can't claim to be an expert on Christianity, but it came much later. Somewhere maybe around 13th century or 12th century, when Christianity took an esoteric, more esoteric and mystic turn. It was esoteric in the beginning, but once the Christianity came into being, maybe after 200, 300 years with Paul, and then it lost its esoteric and the spiritual side. But it came up again because there are deep symbols, Mother Mary and then the child. Shobindo says that Christ is the symbol of the avatar of divine love, and he is also portrayed as the psychic being seated on the lap of Virgin Mary. So that story is very symbolic, again resisting the temptation to get into it. But basically, now here we see that the Madonna of suffering, the mother of grief divine, she is the one who bears the grief, all our grief and pain. Often I portray this that many a times at night people sleep with a lot of pain and suffering. And how is it that when they wake up, often as if, you know, it has gone away somewhere, it has become much less. We have in Indian thought something similar, but not described this way. So in Indian thought, there is the parable of Mahadev. So when Sati plunges in the fire, so with her dead body, Shiva roams the quarters in deep grief. So that's where Shiva assumes the form. She's taking poison because somebody has to take the poison. What is the grief upon earth? The grief is that a world has rejected the divine. This is the grief of Mother Mary. Actually, it's a rejection of the world, of the divine by the world. It's a crucifixion of the divine by the world. So if we look at the seven sorrows, Christ's disappearance, everything, it's basically that she grieves because the world has rejected the divine and it goes along its own way. So that is the grief. Divine also describes it. Not only that, is written a very beautiful article. I think it's in volume 1, if I'm not mistaken. It's called Mater Dolorosa, the suffering that is there upon earth. So the divine mother, there is a portion of the divine mother which partakes this suffering. And then, who is the man of sorrow? The man of sorrow is that entity, that which is bearing this suffering, this sorrow. So we see this in the prayer, 22nd February 1914, that the mother rises high and she is, people are coming to touch her robe and they feel relieved. And on to her left side, she sees the man of sorrow. So she later on calls the word man of sorrows. And he is very happy with the presence and encouraging her, please do this. Because he is the one who is the suffering humanity, if you want to call it. So on one side, we have the suffering humanity, various kinds of suffering. But deep inside, it's the suffering which is embedded because matter is separated from the divine. So if we go to its mystic origin, it is matter separation from the divine, from its origin. And that's why it's very difficult as human beings, when we are completely embedded in material life. It's called a dehatmbodh, to even understand or believe or have faith in something called as the divine. Because that's the ultimate suffering. Shobindo even uses the word that the real tragedy is to die without discovering your soul. And hardly anybody calls it a tragedy. So because when we are entrenched in matter, so it's the suffering of matter. And mother even says that matter just cannot understand that there is grace. It cannot understand that there is no need to suffer. And you will see gospels have been made of suffering. And that's why at one place mother says, it's not a crucified body but a glorified body that will save the world. So there is the Madonna of suffering, mother of grief divine, and there is the man of sorrows. The description comes in Savitri. So man of sorrow is an ignorant humanity which bears the burden of suffering. And the mother of grief divine, the Madonna of suffering, who takes all this, is of course the divine mother. And we'll just read again few lines about her. The mother of the seven sorrows. And she is sitting on a pale, lustrous robe. A rugged and ragged soil was her bare seat. Beneath her feet, a sharp and wounding stone. A divine pity on the peaks of the world. So she is the mother of seven sorrows. People can read it. Actually, it's there in the gospel. The seven stabs that pierced her bleeding heart. This is the mystic Christianity, esoteric. Most mainstream Christianity, it's not like the assumption of the Feast of Mary, which is on 15th August. So it's about divinization of matter, hinted. But the traditional Christian probably will not understand or accept it. The beauty of sadness lingered on her face. Why she is beauty in her sadness? Because this is not her personal sadness. She is bearing the sadness. So this is a beautiful act. Someone who is accepting the sorrow of the world and drinking the poison of the world. So in Indian thought, it is the Shiva who is drinking the poison of the world. Her heart was riven with world's agony. Her eyes were dim with the ancient stain of tears. So she describes, and what does she do? I draw my children's pangs into my breast. I am the nurse of the dolor beneath the stars. So she's the mother of grief divine, Mater Dolorosa. I am the soul of all who wailing writhe under the ruthless harrow of the gods. And she, just two lines we'll read, then we'll go further. But she can bear, help us bear. She cannot save. To save comes the mother of might. But she can save, but she cannot, few she can save. So then comes the Madrona of light who shows the way. So it's also the tamoguni, rajoguni, sattvik, sattuguni prakriti. So you see, when tamoguni prakriti is active, what does it do? It just absorbs. Many people in a state of tamas, they don't experience pain and suffering because there is something which absorbs. And then rajoguni wants conquest, success. And then sattuguni prakriti, which is like a light which is pointing to the way. But Shobindu describes, so at the end, when Savitri has encountered all these Madonnas, then she tells each one, I'll come back. You can bear, but you cannot, you don't have the ultimate secret. So even with Madrona of light, she says, I'll come back. So she comes back later, and all these three gunas and their corresponding lower nature will change. So the mother of grief divine will change into the calm and peace of the Lord. So it'll bear, but it, that's what Shivatva is about. It bears, but it is untouched and undisturbed. And the Madonna of might, the purple robe, the Durga, so that aspect will change into tapas, the force, the conscious force of the divine. And the Madonna of light, or the Sattvic Prakriti, she will change into Prakash, the light which comes from the divine. So these are the three transmutations, transformations of the Prakriti, which Sri Aurobindo speaks about. It describes this in the Synthesis of Yoga, in some detail, and other places also. So she is the one who suffers in us, and she is the one who absorbs our suffering, and she has trust that one day God will come. She waits for God to come through the ages. Imagine, you know, how I often think that in India people waited through centuries of foreign rule, and in that time you have the bhakti springing forth. What they must have suffered, I sometimes just wonder. What these people would have suffered. Going through first the Mughal rule. Before the Mughals, we had invasions. Then we had the Mughal rule. Then the British rule. And all this suffering. Who was absorbing all this? And I take that the classic example is 1947. Such a terrible time. Who was bearing this suffering and absorbing that India started rising in 75 years. It's amazing. Actually, it's really amazing. So what is it that absorbed all that grief? And despite all the challenges, these are the Madonnas which are working. Mother of grief divine, the mother of strength, Durga who guards, and the Madonna of light. So this is the practical implications. So on page 505, her finally, Sri Aurobindo says, I carry the fire that never can be quenched and the compassion that supports the suns. I am the hope that looks towards my God who never came to me till now. His voice I hear that ever says, I come. I know that one day he shall come at last. But then this fellow is there, the man of sorrows, after hearing, from the netherworld. So man of sorrow is as if I am the one meant by, you know, when people, some people say, why God has chosen me to give all the sorrow, suffering, everything, pain. So sometimes they just ask a random question, you came all the way, how many flowers you saw on the way? They are quite surprised, sorry to say, but this one of my standards. So they, what flowers? I said, there is so much beauty around, there is also goodness. Yes, I understand that you are afflicted by pain, but don't let this pain overpower you so much. Because when it overpowers us so much, then we are in that position of the man of sorrows. Shobindu would say this once to Nirodha. Nirodha told him, you see, when I came here before that, sir, believe me, I was a jolly fellow. Because Shobindu would sometimes jokingly call him man of sorrows, always with a, you know, hanging face. He said, sir, I was a very jolly fellow. But after coming here, this man of sorrows has afflicted me. I think partly it is a contribution of your yoga. He says that. And Sri Aurobindo says, no, no, no. Yoga is not meant to do that. It is the confounding atmosphere of the ashram. Of the people. Not of the ashram. He says of the people here. Who will always, you'll see, who are always critical. They will probably, even in front of God, they will be critical. So they are the ones, when you, each time you meet such a person who is always complaining, grudging, must know that man of sorrows, poor person is miserable. So those who are miserable will only talk about misery. So we have the description, he is one of the asuras who needs to be transformed. So there is a description. Okay, where is this? Okay. Yeah. Here he comes. Voice of a tortured titan, once a god. This is the Purvadeva who has fallen. He's describing. I am the man of sorrows. He is a titan. I am the man of sorrows. I am he who is nailed on the white cross of the universe to enjoy my agony. God built the earth. Everything they see, from God to human being, somebody passingly makes a remark, you see. He deliberately did this. Nobody is bothered about you. Why are you thinking? It can go to any extreme. That everybody is against me. My passion he has made his drama's theme. He has sent me naked into his bitter world and beaten me with his rods of grief and pain that I might cry and grovel at his feet. There are philosophies like that. God gives you pain so that you can remember him. I have never understood what kind of a nonsense is this. A god, and how will you pray to a god who first gives you pain? But there are things like that. They are made of tragedy. Something very high and divine. But this is not the path. The path is the path of joy. Sunlit path. So we will come to that last part. So this about the Madonna of sorrow, mother of grief, divine. And have I missed something, or probably I have covered everything? Yeah, the man of sorrows. I think mother of grief divine I just mentioned. Ah, yes, the mother of sorrows. So this is the last part. So we have these two. Mother of sorrows. It's not like the man of sorrows is not the child of the mother of sorrows. Mother of sorrows is the divine mother bearing our burden. And she takes this. That's why we can hope. So she gives hope in return. This is the transaction between us and the Divine Mother. Somebody had beautifully summarized. They said that one lady, she was going through cancers, advanced stages of cancer. And a whole group had gone meeting her. And they asked her that, you have lived here so long, tell us something about it. And they didn't know that she's having blood cancer spread. Actually, very few people know. I knew this. So I didn't tell them. So I said, you just meet. And she was so full of, you know, that joy and light. So they asked, these girls asked her that, what is the sadhana you have done here? She said, oh, this is very simple. Every time we have a sorrow and pain and suffering, we go to the samadhi, we leave it there, we come back free. So many of us have had this experience, isn't it? So she says, we go to the samadhi, we just tell her and I come back happy. And she is suffering from advanced stages of blood cancer. Okay. And that was her state, that we go there, we bow down, we relieve it. So who takes this? This is the mother of sorrows. What does she give in return? Is hope. Eternal hope. So this is where we have to understand. And who is the man of sorrows? He is egoistic fellow. There is nothing like divine bearing our burden. Divine is somebody who has sent us to punish us. All these philosophies where God is punishing us, very clearly springing from this asura. And mother speaks about that when she says, when I came to know of the religions, which obviously she's speaking of the Semitic religions, and she says, I felt they have turned God into a monster and I'm not going to believe in such a God. And that's why when she was traveling to India and on the deck, we know she met some priests who were going to China and then India to convert the people. She didn't go to the mass, Sunday mass. And then they asked her, why didn't you go, aren't you a Christian? He says, no, I believe in God, but not your God. You have made a gospel out of, you know, suffering and all that. Even you see in some other way people are giving stripes to their body. Come on, I mean, you are increasing his suffering. He has already suffered once, but you are not happy with that. So you are suffering also. So who will have to bear it? God has to suffer. And that's why mother says that the soul suffering is not the key. So man of sorrows is just, you can say, the other side, that he is the one who believes that world is meant of only suffering and I have to bear this suffering. What can I do? My karma, my fate or whatever else. And God cannot help me in this because my karma, you know, after all, there is nothing like grace. There is nothing like so let us be rid of man of sorrows once and forever, and let us allow the deathless rose and the deathless flame to blossom and grow. Jai Ma. So with the constraints of time, that's what we have touched upon.
Thank you very much indeed, Lord Bhai, for taking us through these concepts and especially for referring to so many lines in Savitri. So it gives us a chance to go back and look at these in much more detail. I have the questions so far, but I have a couple of questions myself, if I may start. So just going back to the three-bodied Trinity, you mentioned the vital mind. So how can we tell that it is our vital mind that is active in any action? What are the signs for it?
So basically, very simply, it's the mind that imagines. So there is no physical reality, but the mind imagines. So this question comes especially when we are entering the realm of inner experiences. Then this question becomes very prominent, because am I imagining or am I experiencing something real? Very interestingly, when you see the flower of the realization tree and the imagination tree, so there was a question which even was asked to Sri Aurobindo. So he was asked that whether, how do I know whether it is imagination or reality of another order? So that's where this question comes. So of course, the first thing is sincerity. The second is to be very, very careful if anything is flattering us. Now I am putting it in context of sadhana, because otherwise, you know, it can go on. So basically, be very careful of anything that is flattering us, anything which is cutting us off from the divine by, you know, these suggestions. You are a sinner, you are a bad guy, you are a rakshasa, you are an... So this is where we should be very careful. Anything which is coming between us and the divine, either by way of aggrandizement or by way of punishing and a sense of sinner, is definitely imagination gone berserk, vital mind working in a wrong direction. Having said that, the mother said very clearly that this mind, vital mind and imagination, can open a path. That's, it has a purpose. So people nowadays used conscious imagery. So Sri Aurobindo also said in the beginning, these trickles come like that. They may suddenly flash in the mind as an... Apparently, we have no clue how they have come. For example, one bows at the samadhi and feels a little as if, you know, chue koi mujhe par nazar na aaye. I mean, the divine hand just stroking our head. So, is it imagination? Sri Aurobindo says, if you discard all these things as imagination, then you will never move forward. So, these touches will come like that. So, we have to be only careful of two things. That, am I becoming prominent? If not... If there is a touch of the divine, suddenly you hear as if a snatch of music came. But physical mind will say that, where is the music? Nobody is playing the instrument. And the rational mind, if it analyzes, it will just rubbish it apart. So anything, very simply, my ultimate take, based on all that they have written, this mind is not to be discarded, because rational mind discards it. And by discarding it, it washes the baby with the bathwater. She says that use this faculty, use this mind. So two ways we can use it. One is very consciously imagine beautiful things. Imagine, you know, the song that became very prominent. So imagine beautiful things. So it's a faculty given to us. It has its own power upon it. It has its own energy, dynamism, and maybe it'll end up adding to the... That's why Shobindu describes it as a red wild ass. At places he describes, it's like a pitchfork, which may hit or miss. So imagine, a golden light entering into us. But what we should not do is that, you know, some people, because they are doing this as an imagery, they start saying this is supramental light. No, be careful. Don't start letting it take over us completely. But this imagination as an imagery is a wonderful thing. Always imagine beautiful things. That's what the mother says, that always, always should imagine beautiful things. Second aspect is, from the sadhana point of view, in case you have these experiences spontaneously, for which there is no data of the physical mind, just doesn't understand. As I said, a snatch of music. Smell is very common. In this ashram, when you sit, sometimes smell of rose, sometimes smell of jasmine, spontaneously. Now, don't start doubting it. You were neither actively imagining it, nor is there a physical data to support where it came from. But this is very clearly an inner experience. So any experience which arises spontaneously, where you were not, for example, you were not imagining, and suddenly you, I was narrating one of the experiences yesterday, that you go to a, you know, place, Gumpa in Ladakh, and you see Kali, Mother Kali, formidable Kali. I felt she is breathing, but I said, how can it be? I believe that this is not, this is a statue of Kali, but very living. So I carried it in my head all these decades, till I went, few years back, and I was looking for that. The only thing I was looking at in Ladakh was that formidable Kali touching the roof, and I took all the people with me. We'll go and have that darshan of Kali. She's so living. That's when I realized there is no such Kali anywhere in this whole territory. Then I realized, okay, it wasn't an experience, but it was so real, so real. So it spontaneously came. I was not doing any Kali mantra. I didn't have a, affinity to Kali. Similarly, seeing the mother, some people see in their vision spontaneously. So any experience which arises spontaneously without the mind trying to, that's why mother was not very keen on trying to, form an experience, because mind has a formative power. But without that, you are turned toward the divine, and suddenly, like a flash, an experience emerges. 99.99% it is true. Unless it is feeding your ego, then even if it is true, keep quiet. Don't follow it. Or it is pushing you in the dumps. Divine will never come and say, you are a useless fellow. He will lift you out of everything. So with these two cautions, but if we are consciously imagining, okay, fine, nothing wrong with that. But we should know the difference between conscious imagination and the reality. Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. And there's the next question is something that I was going to ask anyway, but somebody else is also asking. Is it possible to see purple or blue light in meditation, and what does that
mean? Yes, yes, yes. Very much, very much. Seeing lights in meditation. So each light will have its own significance. So coming to blue light has many shades. So it could be a mild, very mild light. It's normally it indicates the levels of the mind. So if you see a violet light, to a more leaning towards violet, you are probably a deep blue, you are seeing Krishna's blue. But if you see a lighter shade of blue where it's mixed with the white, so you are seeing Shurbindo's light. They are very similar. And if you are seeing a purple light, I mean, it's very difficult to recognize purple color, at least for me. But, one can. It's a rare color. It's not very common. You don't see it all the time. But if one sees a purple light, that means that there is a special blessing which is being bestowed. Future will unveil and reveal. As I said, the purple light is an indicator that you are going to in some way be a leader in... maybe a thought leader, or that kind of power, energy is beginning to work in us. So purple light is very, very special, not very common, very difficult to distinguish the shades, at least for me. But there are people who are very good at lights. And similarly, we have orange light. Now, orange light, many people mistake immediately that it is the supermind. So orange light of the supermind is a very different shade. But the common orange light is the light which is mixed with the earth, or the like earthly light is red. So we can say that the action of the divine veiled upon earth, as it is acting upon earth. Red is obviously earth, and green is generally the vital world. See, the forest are green, so very simple to remember. I think that's the most of the lights are shades of that. White, of course, is mother's light. That's the easiest to recognize and easiest to handle. It's transparent. Mother's white light is white, but it's kind of transparent. It's not just white like we imagine white. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And one more question. So in our sadhana, if the bhakti is not spontaneous, is it something you can cultivate? Does that mean you lean more on the path of knowledge or works?
Okay, so in our sadhana, let me put it that way, because it's an integral yoga, and even traditionally, all those who say not really integral yogins, but they are on the path of tapasya through the mind, they end up at the end, they end up cultivating a kind of bhakti, which is very impersonal. For instance, the Upanishad says something very interesting, and it's said by a tapasvi, na yamatma balhine namedana bahuna shrutin yam veshe vranute tena labhyastashe satma vivranute tanusam. So bhakti will take that you, that it is the grace of God. So they do reach there, but after reaching, then you will automatically develop a kind of bhakti which is more impersonal. But the journey is not going to be easy. Whereas the path of bhakti, right from the beginning, it's like, you know, he is carrying you, she is carrying us. So this is the difference. Now if it is not there, which is very common by the way, bhakti comes at the end. If you read the synthesis of yoga, it is very evident. So even in both the yoga of integral self-perfection, in the yoga of the Gita, in the synthesis of yoga, all of them, bhakti is the last. So bhakti is the crown. So first thing is knowledge, because if it starts with bhakti, there is always a little risk. We may mistake emotional bhakti for the psychic bhakti. And many people do that. Emotional bhakti is a transactional bhakti. It's not really bhakti in the real sense. The Gita will put it in the two inferior modes of bhakti. But the Gita also takes caution when it describes the four kind of bhaktas. It speaks of arth and artharthi, transactional and distress call. But the true bhakta, it speaks about the jnani, jigyasu and the jnani. So it is safer in a way to start with jnana. Jnana means discerning intellect, which can differentiate between true and false, right and wrong. This is very important. And if this endeavor is turned toward the divine, if it doesn't flatter the ego that I am a big tapasvi, then very soon it will reach bhakti through the passage of karma. That's how the Gita puts it. Sri Aurobindo makes it easier for us. The Gita starts with jnana, goes through karma, then takes us to bhakti. Sri Aurobindo has made it easier in the synthesis, starts with karma, because you know karma is every one of us. So start with karma, then bhakti begins to, because karma has inbuilt, karma yoga is inbuilt within it bhakti. You have to offer it to the divine. So karma start with, and then make sure that the discerning intellect becomes active. Otherwise one can accept any kind of impulse and urge as oh, this is part of bhakti, which can be very dangerous. So it's important to, we should not think that because one is striving through knowledge, it's something inferior. So this is very important in its own right, but true knowledge. Intellectual knowledge is a different thing altogether. What matters is why I am seeking knowledge. If it is seeking knowledge of the divine and his ways in the world, that's true knowledge. But if I am just using the mind to analyze and understand, believing that my mind can understand, then it will only puff up my mental ego. So, but if that right way of knowledge is discernment, and this will, and karma, then the bhakti blossoms. It's best if it happens that way. Because blind bhakti can also be very dangerous. And both Sri Aurobindo and the mother have spoken about it. Of course, blind, let me qualify, because there is a kind of blind bhakti in the sense that I don't know about God, but I have bhakti. That is fine. But blind bhakti, where I just take it that everything that is rising in my mind, I have given myself to the mother, so all that thoughts that come to me, suggestions are coming from mother. I have met people like that, and it completely derails the yoga. So one should be very, very careful. So knowledge first is a nice thing. Nothing wrong with that. This is the logical process of the yoga. In yoga of integral self-perfection, it starts with knowledge. First he says, even in that last part of synthesis, then works. And then the bhakti should come. By then you are well grounded and ego self has taken a back seat. Maybe largely it has become just an instrument of the divine working. Then yes, bhakti, where one gives oneself completely to the divine and is ready to accept everything, total surrender, it's perfectly fine. How to cultivate it? Well, everything can develop and be cultivated. One is, as I said, in the logical sequence. If you pursue any path of yoga to the end, you will cultivate bhakti. You see Sri Raman Maharshi, if you look at him, he was a path of self-inquiry about, you know, not this, not this, and ultimately, but at the end, some of his conversations, he talks about surrender. So you will reach bhakti if you are sincere in that. Even a proper tapasvi will reach. But then bhakti can be cultivated. One of the commonest way of cultivating bhakti is the company of the God lovers. So that's one advantage of being in places where there are people who love God. And Ken Upanishad also says the same thing, that seek the company of those who are like flowers and you are like, what is it, madhumakhi, honeybee, which can draw from that. So company of God lovers is one of the classic ways. Then reading about the life, that's why I always say that, you know, one is you read the works of Sri Aurobindo, like what they have done, like philosophical treatises, like the Life Divine. Many people don't realize that reading the life has its own tremendous impact. Of course, reading the life means written by somebody XYZ who really is into it. For instance, Life of Sri Aurobindo by A.B. Purani. Sri Aurobindo, his life unique. So when you read that part, you especially, you know, Sri Aurobindo is life unique, Rishabh Chand's book, you will end up cultivating love for Sri Aurobindo. You will, but if you read the Life Divine, you see Sri Aurobindo as, you know, mighty Niagara Falls entering into us. But if you read Sri Aurobindo's life, especially as I said, Rishabh Chand's life, Sri Aurobindo's life unique, excellent bhakti develops, even 12 years with Sri Aurobindo for that matter. So by reading, that's why in India we have these parallel things. One is Upanishads and the Veda, which is more about jnana, and the second is Ramayana and the Mahabharata and the Bhagavat. So when you read the Ramayana and the Bhagavat especially, Mahabharata is a blend of, it's largely jnana and karma. It doesn't much touch upon bhakti. But if you read the Ramayana and the Bhagavat, you end up developing bhakti. So the life of the master, the life of the one, but in a way which written or spoken by a bhakta, it will cultivate bhakti. So that's the way to cultivate. Yes.
Thank you very much for that.
And we can ask for bhakti. Very simply, yes.
And I'm mindful that you have to now leave for your next session, so thank you. And
yes,
what I will do, if it's okay with you, is there are one or two other questions which I can email to you.
Yes, please do so. Please do so. And yes, please email me the questions. I'll be very, very happy to take care of that, yes. And I'm sorry because I have to rush through because the next session is going to start in another 10 minutes, yes. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Again, and we look forward to your next joining us
in yes.
Our workshop.
Yes.
Namaste.
Namaste. Chema.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.